Hey, it's Anna Sale, and I want to thank you for listening to Death, Sex, and Money, where I explore the big questions and hard choices that are often left out of polite conversation. You can hear new episodes ad-free every week on Amazon Music, where you can find Death, Sex, and Money and all of your Slate favorites without the ads.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com, from the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
Hey, it's Anna. Wherever you are, we hope you are finding some pockets of relaxation and cool this summer. We've been hearing from a lot of you lately in our email inbox. Some of you are sharing your experiences of estrangement with us. Others of you are describing your personal style transformations as we are gathering again in public after so much time apart. And we're also hearing your fears after the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade, and your questions when it comes to student loans and public service loan forgiveness, as federal student loan payments are set to resume at the end of August after being on pause since the start of the pandemic. All of this comes in through our email inbox at deathsexmoney@wnyc.org. And our ongoing conversation with you is what makes this show so special. So thank you for being a part of our listening community, whether you're new or have been here for years. We love being able to ask you big, sometimes sensitive questions, and to hear the stories you share back with us. Again, that email is deathsexmoney@wnyc.org. And as we sort through the latest stories and questions you're sending us, and we work on some episodes that'll be coming out soon, we thought we'd share another episode with you based on stories you told us. This one is about drinking and alcohol use. This episode first ran in 2019, pre-pandemic, which obviously feels like a really different time. And since then, in the first year of the pandemic, deaths related to alcohol use increased in the United States by 25%. So we thought it'd be a good time to listen back to this episode, to hear our shared experiences of drinking, not drinking, and when some of you realized it was time to cut back. We hope you enjoy it.
I always wondered when I was going to get my adult card. You know, you think it's going to be at 18 and then at 21. And really now I'm thinking maybe it's 34 is when I got my adult card, and drinking it on a Thursday night makes Friday not so pleasurable.
Your adult card comes in the form of just a hangover, feeling crappy. That's what adulthood feels like.
It's not fair. They don't tell you that.
This is Death, Sex, and Money.
Let's talk about alcohol.
The show from WNYC about the things we think about a lot.
Not drinking definitely did not solve my problems.
And need to talk about more.
Oh, this is what a hangover is? Oh my God, it's the worst.
I'm Anna Sale. Carrie is a listener in her mid-30s. She lives in Indianapolis, and she got in touch with us when we asked you to tell us about your relationships with alcohol. What do you like when you're a little buzzed?
I'm giggly, and my face usually gets a little more pink, and I lose my volume control to some degree. And if there's a microphone, I might pick it up and sing something. You just never know.
Carrie told me that drinking is a part of her daily routine, She likes having a glass of wine with her husband after work during the week, and then on the weekends.
I have a pretty core group of girlfriends, and if we're getting together, there's definitely going to be alcohol there. So we'll have, usually if it's the ladies, some wine, or we're really into the like spiked sparkling waters right now, probably because those don't have a lot of carbs and we're all very, you know, carb conscious and we're trying to be healthy and transitions into drinking those instead of drinking Bud Light.
And how many of those will you have when you're with your girlfriends?
Three or four. If it's a night where we're trying to hang out and party, you know, maybe five, maybe.
But as she's getting older, Carrie is noticing that all that alcohol doesn't go down as easily as it used to. And she's starting to wonder what it would be like to cut back a little.
It's been a piece of everything since we've turned 21 or 18 that we have, you know, always had a drink or been drinking when we've been at parties. And it is a fundamental shift. And I just don't want that to enter into the dynamic.
Would it be a big deal if you were with a group of women that you hang out with on a weekend and they're all getting ready to crack open their spiked seltzers and you're like, I'm just going to have plain seltzer?
It's funny that you're hitting on this because summertime just came around here in Indy and we're probably all going to be getting together soon. And I have had that conversation in my mind. I definitely think that at least someone in the group would say, what's up? Or how come you're not drinking? Or
are you pregnant? That's what they will say.
I know. Every time. I just don't want anybody to think that if I'm not drinking and they are, that I would be judging. And I still want them to come over to my house. And I still want them to hang out with me. And it's so funny that I'm 34. And that is a worry, that if I weren't drinking, that maybe the party would move to someone else's house.
When we asked about the role alcohol plays in your life, we heard that for a lot of you, drinking is about more than getting a buzz.
I enjoy, you know, the taste of beer, having a glass of wine.
It helps me to relax when I go on dates with my husband.
I enjoy being loud and rude and whatnot.
There's so much of adult life that's built around alcohol.
Just try to go to a picnic with friends and not have a drink.
They think I'm being like a buzzkill.
And then the scary part is that you've become so conditioned to this is what I need to have fun. This is what I need to go on dates. This is what I need to have a great night out with my friends. And now all of a sudden, you're 31 and you're thinking, if I was to stop drinking, how do I even exist?
It's easy to think of drinking in black and white. Either you do it or you don't. But the thing we heard from you is that in the middle, there's a big, confusing gray area.
You know, am I having a drink because I need a drink or because I want a drink? Or is it, who's in control?
I don't know that I would identify as sober, but I'm not not sober.
I'm trying to quit drinking, but I drink once a week, you know? It would feel weird to show up to a recovery group in that stage.
There has been times, not a lot, but a couple of times where I like go into the fridge, I grab a beer, I go into the bathroom, I lock the door, I crack it, and I drink it.
I don't get drunk, but it has become a ritual for me that I rarely forego.
More than 70% of American adults drink alcohol. And the number of binge drinkers has been increasing dramatically the last 15 years across demographics, but especially for women of all ages and older adults. According to the CDC, binge drinking means 5 or more drinks per day for men or 4 or more drinks per day for women at least once a week. But you don't have to drink that much in one sitting to raise red flags.
I am very aware that the amount I currently drink would be considered a problem by, say, a doctor.
This is a voice memo we got from a listener named Rachel. She told me she drinks pretty much every day, 1 or 2 drinks at a time. And for women, the CDC calls that heavy drinking because it's 8 or more drinks a week. Rachel knows those statistics because she's a therapist who's counseled people struggling with addiction.
You know, I don't have conflict with my spouse or my kids. I don't neglect household chores or drink during the day. But I do look forward to it. And I sometimes will do things like have one drink before my husband gets home so that after he gets home, I can have another one and he won't suspect that I've had two.
Rachel lives in the Midwest with her husband and two young kids. When I got on the phone with her, she told me that at the end of a long day of seeing clients and parenting, drinking helps, and she's not sure how to feel about that.
When I get to a place where I realize that, like, that is becoming my shortcut to self-care, that that's, like, the only thing that I'm doing, like, if feeling buzzed at the end of the day is the only way that I'm achieving that's personal space for myself, like, that's a problem, I think.
And what's the drink you start with when it's, like, time to have a drink and unwind?
So I either will, you know, open a bottle of wine or, you know, one that's already open, or a gin and tonic. Usually those are my two go-tos.
Do you feel like, I sort of feel like pop culture in this moment is definitely encourages me as a young mom to drink and indulge. Like, the idea that, like, that we need this, or we, you know, at the end of a long day, this is the way that we can, like, get in a bubble bath with Dove bars and a glass of white wine. Like, that's what we're supposed to do to take care of ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. And it, you know, and it's just so easy to just pour a glass of wine and call it good. You know, like, I checked the self-care box for the day. I think it might have been my husband we were having a conversation about my drinking and, like, my desire to just, like, check out at the end of the day. And he was like, well, but, like, you deserve more, though. He's like, you deserve that, yes, and more. Like, you deserve to leave this house. He's like, challenge yourself to, like, think of something else. And, like, when he said that, I think I was kind of defensive. I'm like, well, like, you think of something else. Like, this works for me. Good, you know? Like, who are you to tell me I have to do something else? But the more I thought about it and what he really meant, I was like, yeah, that, like, that's true. And it's work to find it, which sucks. And I don't like doing that work. But it's something I'm really, really pushing myself to do right now. It's like, yes, you can have your glass of wine, but, like, then what else are you going to do?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. There have honestly been days where I decided I wasn't going to, and I got home and I was dealing with a potty training disaster, and I was like, screw that, I'm having a drink anyway.
A lot of you wrote in about drinking to take the edge off of parenting. And some of you wrote in about watching your parents drink.
Does your dad know you call him an alcoholic?
He does. He does. He doesn't really like that.
A listener we're calling Horatio told us he worries about how much his dad drinks and has for years.
He doesn't admit to it being like an addiction of alcohol, but he does consume a lot of it every night. He was in the military and got injured doing his work, and it's really just a big coping mechanism for his pain.
You've talked about his drinking with him?
Yeah, yeah, because sometimes he travels for work. He's usually a construction supervisor, and so he hasn't had a DUI, but he's been at risk of one certain times, and that worried me. I've gone off and on of, like, hey, Dad, let's be sober together, so that we can become, like, better together. I want you to be healthy with me.
And what will he say when you ask him not to drink?
Sometimes I've just, like, okay, I'll keep it in mind. Thank you for being honest with me. But also, like, well, it's not that much of a problem.
Horatio is 22 now. He's living away from home for the first time and thinking about how much he wants to drink.
I go through processes of, should I just quit because I don't want my family to be affected if I do have this addictive lifestyle? But I don't know.
Are you currently drinking alcohol?
I am. I do. I still have Mike's Hard Lemonade in my fridge at home, and I'll have a Mike's Hard with my dinner and watch shows.
By yourself?
Yeah, mostly by myself, sometimes with roommates.
When you reach for that Mike's Hard Lemonade, sounds like there's a, you know, there's a heaviness that comes with alcohol, having kind of seen what your dad's going through, what is it that you're reaching for?
I think it's reaching for just, I guess it is a little bit of a release from like an 8-hour shift of like being all scussied up in business casual clothes, and I can get home and, you know, make my own food and be control of my own environment, that I can't necessarily like do that in office always. And being like just kind of relaxing. And I guess alcohol is a little bit of my relaxer at a certain point.
You know, in my 20s, I drank a lot, but so was pretty much everyone in my life around me.
I imagined that anyone and everyone around me holding a beer was also a binge drinker.
My mom was in rehab when I turned 21, so there's always been this weird kind of dichotomy of this is the substance that she had been using to try to kill herself, and this is the substance that all of my friends use to have fun and dance and flirt.
I mean, I'm pretty good at chugging beers. I can chug a pint in probably less than 4 seconds. I've beat a lot of boys doing that. I'm really good at keg stands.
How old were you when you did your last keg stand?
I was 24.
A listener we're calling Jean is 32 now, but back in her 20s, she drank a lot for work. Her job was being a beer girl, as she calls it, working in kitchens and bars, and finally in marketing for a microbrewery in the Pacific Northwest. She spent a lot of time at beer competitions and festivals.
You know, at one event, I might have 5 or 6 beers in one night. And yeah, I loved it. I met a lot of people. I had a lot of friends. People loved me. So every time I showed up, everyone was excited to see me. And that felt good.
Were there ever stretches during that time where you thought, I don't really feel like drinking beer this month, I'm going to take a break?
I wouldn't say this month. It was more like, I don't feel like drinking beer today, I'm going to take a break. But by the time it started, I mean, it really hit me that I couldn't keep doing it forever. I started to feel the toll on my body. And there was a time clearly where I was like, this is not sustainable.
When you were noticing that drinking was starting to be a little harder on your body, what did you notice first?
I threw up a lot. You know, it was like I would drink all night and go to bed. And the first thing that would happen is I'd wake up in the morning and I'd have to throw up. And so a lot of times I'd spend my mornings just being ridiculously hungover and puking for hours upon hours upon hours. I remember a specific time where I was judging a beer festival, and we had been drinking all night long, and then we had to judge beer the next day. And I just could not take another sip of beer. And I felt so bad because as I'm judging these breweries' beers in between types, you know, styles of beer, I was going to the bathroom, silently puking in the bathroom, and then coming back to judge the next round of beer.
Jean left that job about 5 years ago. A big reason was that she realized that while she was working, she was driving drunk.
There would be days where I would drink 8, 9, 10 beers and then have to drive home from a festival in the next city over. And, you know, I had a 300-mile drive to get home after drinking all day long. And it's crazy because I never got pulled over. I never got in an accident. I never got a DUI.
When you left the brewery and when it was no longer your job to be the fun woman passing out beer, when you went out, did you have to figure out how to be in a different way when you were drinking?
Yeah, most certainly. I still feel, right, 32 years old now, and I still struggle with knowing how to be out and about when I'm drinking. Because, you know, more so than being addicted to alcohol or being addicted to beer, I was addicted to the attention that I was given because of that environment. And when I got out of that environment, more so than missing the beer, I missed all that attention. And I had to really redefine myself so that I felt valuable, because I definitely felt like I didn't have anything to offer if I wasn't the happy, flirty beer girl.
Coming up, strategies from those of you who decided to cut back on your drinking, and stories from those of you who know you need to.
It's getting to the point where I think that I might need help. And it's scary to even say that out loud and look at myself. I don't know.
As I said at the beginning of this episode, you have been sending us questions about having to start making payments again on your federal student loans after the pause that's been in place throughout the pandemic goes away at the end of August. We are collecting your stories and questions, and we'll be putting them to an expert to help you through this transition. One listener, Sarah, told us she moved to Australia during the pandemic and is no longer eligible for public service loan forgiveness, but she's not sure how aggressively to resume payments when they're due if some sort of other government help could come.
I'm waiting, along with everybody else, to see what the Biden administration does about forgiveness, even if it's just 10 grand.
You can send your questions and stories about student loans to us by Tuesday, August 2nd, and we'll do our best to get you some good answers. Record a voice memo and send it to us at deathsexmoney@wnyc.org. This episode is brought to you by Fail Better, David Duchovny's new podcast with Lemonada Media. On Fail Better, David, who has experienced both low and high profile failures throughout his life, explores the vast world of failure, how it holds us back, propels us forward, and ultimately shapes our lives. Each week, he will chat with guests like Ben Stiller, Bette Midler, and more about how our perceived failures have actually been our biggest catalysts for growth, revelation, and even healing. Through these conversations, he hopes listeners can learn how to embrace the opportunity of failure and fail better together. Fail Better is out now wherever you get your podcasts. I want to thank you for listening and for all your support as we at Death, Sex, and Money have made our move to Slate. Your stories, voice memos, and emails have meant so much to the team. As part of this transition, there's a new way to support our show financially at Slate, our new home, and you'll get something special in return. Subscribe to Slate Plus, and you'll not only support our work on Death, Sex, and Money, you'll get access to new benefits, including listening to us and all of the other great shows Slate makes, like Slow Burn and Dakota Ring, without any ads or sponsor breaks. To subscribe, just click Try Free at the top of the Death, Sex, and Money show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/DSM+ to get access wherever you listen. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
This is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. I'm Anna Sale. There are a lot of things that make you change the way you drink.
I have had a DUI.
I converted to the Mormon church.
I was more of someone that just couldn't stop once they got started.
That shit is too damn expensive, and ain't nobody got time for that.
This is a voice memo we got from a listener named Marva in New York City. She's 29 and works in tech. And before she moved to New York, she lived abroad in South Africa and in France.
I got very, very, very used to drinking quality alcohol that was also extremely cheap.
But when she got back to the U.S., she had sticker shock when it came time to buy drinks. So she told me she made a rule for herself.
I sat down and I was really into budgeting at that time. And I looked at how much I was making, which I was working in a nonprofit, so it was not a lot of money. And I looked at what I wanted to be spending money on. And in order to be able to spend money on the things that I like most wanted to, I knew that I had to let certain things go, and not buying alcohol or being intentional about the way that I buy alcohol just seemed like kind of like an easy way to manage that, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So you're like looking at a spreadsheet and you're deciding, here's my new rule about alcohol.
Yeah. Yeah. So for example, like a lot of my money goes to like traveling. So I'd prefer to like put my money into that, for example, as opposed to like a $15 drink.
For the most part, Marva tries not to spend any money at all on alcohol. But when the booze is free, she indulges.
So I was at a wedding this past weekend and there was an open bar, which was great.
Uh-huh.
But I ended up drinking more than I should have. And I knew it. Like I knew as I was drinking that last glass of wine, I knew that I didn't need that. But I did it anyway. And I was really disappointed in myself the day after. Like when I have it, like I must consume it all or as much as I can.
Do you ever have a special occasion where you buy yourself a bottle of wine?
No, nothing has come up, but I will say I just started a new job within the last 3 or 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have like our Friday happy hour, which is free. But in addition to that, like I hope nobody from work hears this. If you stay till the end, I know like it's a common thing. People might take like a bottle of whatever's left over. But I have stayed till the end quite a few times. And I do have two bottles that I've taken from work. And I have not opened them yet. I don't know what I'm waiting for. I don't know if I'm waiting for a special occasion or if I'm waiting for like someone else to hit me up and say, hey, I'm having a party. And then I can just like reach for that and bring it. But I do have those on standby just in case.
A listener named Meredith also wrote in about finding a creative way to monitor her alcohol consumption. She's never wanted to give it up completely. She grew up in an Irish and Scottish family, and for her, drinking brings up a lot of nice memories.
Even when we were kids, we would have family happy hour. So, of course, the kids would have like a Shirley Temple or a ginger ale or something. But my parents would always use it as a time to catch up and connect with each other. So we got included, too.
And so in your mind, like, what are some words that you think of to describe, like, what it's like when your family's all drinking together?
It's a little silly. We're all really loud. Yeah, and then we're generous. I think hospitality is really important to my family, too. So, you know, even if you're drinking or not drinking, you know, we want you to come in. We want you to have a beverage, you know, soda water or a glass of wine, and be comfortable in our house.
And that's how Meredith approached drinking as an adult, too. She got a job in politics, moved to D.C., and alcohol remained a part of her life. In her mid-20s, though, she started a new tradition.
So the real origin story of Sober September is that I had to be in a pink bridesmaid's dress on October 1st for a wedding. And so I made a bet with myself that I was going to, you know, give up drinking for the month of September and go to the gym a couple times a week. Like nothing crazy on the workout side, but it was a big step to not drink, you know, for a whole month. And I invented the excuse, right? I just made it up. I said, uh-huh. Oh, it's Sober September. And everybody thought, I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. Did you? And now that I do it every September, people are like, oh, do you do that every year? I'm like, yeah.
How many Sober Septembers have there been?
The first one was in 2012.
A lot of them.
A lot, yeah. And now I've moved to I don't drink during Lent either. And that has a little bit more spiritual component, of course. Sober September has been like a really great practice.
Has it ever felt like you're testing yourself to make sure you can stop completely?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, that's why I describe it as like a light switch, right? Like, Like one of, in the first couple of days, I'm always like, do I have a headache? Do I feel weird? Does my body feel deprived? And if I can say no, I feel great.
Still, when September is over, Meredith loves getting back to drinking with her family and now with her boyfriends, too.
So my boyfriend's parents are Peruvian Americans. And so like a really fun night is we'll go over to their house and my boyfriend's father will make pisco sours. Mm-hmm. And he just like takes so much pride in making them, you know, like he like hand squeezes all the lime juice. And so like, we'll have like a round of pisco sours to like kick it off and then we'll barbecue and then no one else in the house drinks like dry white wine. And that's my thing. So, you know, my boyfriend's mom will be like, Hey, we remembered that you like this, you know? And so like, then I'll have a couple glasses of that while we're like sitting around and talking and, that's a really fun night.
Marva used her budget to cut down on her drinking. Meredith used the calendar. And Drew, a 35-year-old listener in Texas, used a pill. When he was young, Drew watched his dad struggle with alcohol abuse. And about a year ago, he felt like he was drinking more than he wanted. So he asked his doctor to prescribe him Antabuse, a drug that makes you violently sick if you drink while it's in your system. At first, Drew's doctor suggested more traditional approaches, like counseling or a 12-step program. But Drew just wanted a little help cutting back. He didn't want to get completely sober.
And so I kind of explained it to him. Hey, I don't have a huge alcohol problem, but, you know, every third night I get that little voice saying, hey, you know, it would be great as a beer and a cigarette. And this just takes that temptation away completely. And he was very cool about it, you know, wrote me a prescription for it. And that's still what I do. I take one either every day or every third day. And then, you know, if the weekend's coming and there's like, you know, a gathering where I might want to have a couple of beers at, you know, I'll make sure I don't take one for the 5 days leading into that so I can have a couple of beers at, you know, a party or what have you.
And have you ever had alcohol after taking Antabuse?
I have. I've mistimed that once or twice. And you figure it out really quickly. It hits
what
you.
What happens?
Oh, God. You can really figure it out within half a beer. Your skin will flush bright red. Your heart will start palpitating. Shortness of breath. You'll start to get a headache. Your eyes have trouble focusing. It's hard to think. And this is from about half a beer. So it hits you really hard really quickly.
When you do drink, when you cycle off, when you plan ahead and don't take the pill for a few days, do you feel guilty? Do you feel like you're giving yourself a treat? How do you think about it?
It's really like giving myself a treat. If it's just three or four beers, you know, then it's a bottle of wine with my significant other, then it's this is a nice thing. And I know I'm not going to do it again tomorrow. So I'm just going to enjoy this while the evening lasts. And I'm not an alcoholic. I don't consider myself an alcoholic. I like to abuse alcohol, but I don't have all the crazy symptoms of alcoholism and drinking to a bottom and, you know, everything that's associated with that.
How do you think about that distinction, having seen alcoholism up close in your home growing up?
Man, that's a heavy question. I guess I never got quite to the point of, you know, I was able, you know, on multiple points to just kind of stop drinking when I wanted to, and just through force of will. And to me, I think that's a big part of the distinction is if you can make a choice to not drink, then you are, you know, maybe not as down that path of addiction. That to me is the marker of an alcoholic, or that's where I, you know, draw the distinction.
I have a very clear memory of the exact moment in my life when I thought to myself, I really just want to have 3 gin and tonics and feel completely removed from my life.
I was using drinking to mask some pretty serious PTSD.
To sort of run away from my own issues with my career and job stuff and finances and relationships and men. And I was definitely using it to avoid my life.
I believe that I was always very, very uncomfortable in my own skin, at dis-ease with being me. And drinking helped me feel a little bit more comfortable, a little less raw. It worked for a long time, and then it didn't anymore.
One night, I drank too much, and it pretty much ended my job.
I hurt myself. I gashed my leg. I still have a scar.
I got rushed to the emergency room because I woke up puking up blood and pooing out blood.
The last time I blacked out, I woke up in a hotel room with a man that I don't even know where the heck I connected with him.
And that was kind of it. That was the death knell of me drinking.
Just like, this is over. I'm done. I'm done.
I chose to go into 12-step program.
I admitted into detox. And I've never looked back.
I haven't had a drink in over 3 months.
It's about 12:30 on a Thursday night. It just so happens to be my 1 year anniversary of quitting drinking.
Now I have 16 years of sobriety.
And I am 2 years, 7 months, and 16 days sober.
My sobriety date is May 5, 1978.
2 years without alcohol. Here I am. Happy birthday to me.
One listener who wanted to be called Jackie sent us a voice memo because she wants to change the way she's drinking.
It's gotten to the point where I can't function without it.
Jackie just turned 21 last month, but she's been drinking since she was 18. She's worked a lot in restaurants and just recently got a new office job in customer service.
I mean, I can go through my workday, but the whole workday, I'm just counting down the hours to when I can drink, when it's the evening and it's acceptable for me to have a drink. I consider myself a very outgoing and fun person, and I used to be able to be that without alcohol. But at this point, I need alcohol to just be myself, or at least that's what it feels like. And it's scary. Like, I'm scared, and I don't feel like I can talk to anyone about it.
What do you drink?
I drink a lot of beers, and I take a lot of shots of vodka, mainly vodka. I drink almost every day.
And when you drink every day, where do you drink?
Just at home. My kitchen is kind of hidden from the rest of the apartment. If you take a few steps towards the back of the kitchen, no one can see you. And so something that I've noticed I do a lot is I take shots without other people. Like, even on nights when we're all taking shots, I'll like go into the kitchen and just take a few more. And I don't know why I do that.
And they don't know it's a secret.
Yeah. I mean, I've kind of said, you know, passing things that like, oh, I need to stop drinking so much. Like, but I've never used the word alcoholic. I've never said that word out loud to the people in my life before.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you have a problem with alcoholism?
I think I do. Yeah. I think I depend on it. Like I'm like obsessed with it. I don't know.
Jackie didn't want to say exactly where she lives, but it's in a big city. She shares a 2-bedroom apartment with a friend and her boyfriend. She knows he's noticed the problem, too.
He's a little bit older than me, just by a couple years, but he doesn't drink like I do. And it definitely comes off as, like, just I'm out of control. It's obnoxious. Like, you know, it's not a good look. It's not a good look to get absolutely shit-faced and embarrass yourself. And I've embarrassed him a few times. It's nothing ever too bad, but it's just me acting crazy. And then, like, one time at a party, I tried to take a shot, but my body, like, rejected it. And I, like, spit it all over his friend. And that sucked really bad. Just things like that. I know that he has to roll his eyes at me all the time because of the things that I do.
Has your drinking affected you at work, do you think?
Yeah, a little bit, I think. Because, like, I wake up late all the time. I mean, I've only been late to work once, but I have had to spend so much money on calling a Lyft because I'm like really, really pushing it. Like, I will call the Lyft at 7:50 and I need to be there at 8. Like, I would be saving so much money if I was just taking the train like I should. And also, it does make me feel sick. Like, I have headaches so much. Like, I can feel my body, like I'm really young. I'm 21. I can feel my body just, like, slowing down and being affected by it. But the only thing that makes it feel better is drinking more.
You have cravings.
Yeah.
And when you picked up your phone to record a voice memo for us, why did you want to talk about your drinking?
Well, because I think I knew deep down that I was starting to have a problem and I was starting to get scared. And I'm so embarrassed. Like, I'm so embarrassed about it. I don't want to talk to anyone about it. But I needed to do something. And, like, when you guys are like, hey, call us. Like, when I heard that first, like, when I heard it for the first time in the episode, I felt like I just got punched in my stomach. I was like, oh, you have to do that. That's all you can do right now. Like, this is the control that you can take.
That's something that felt within reach.
Mm-hmm.
What would be the next thing that you could do?
I think the next thing I would do is I would have to put it in the hands of someone else. I'd have to say, hey, like, don't let me drink. Like, don't let me, because I can't do it myself. I'm just so not ready to confront it, I guess.
Can you explain that to me? Because we're talking about it and you're confronting it. You're admitting it.
Yeah, that's true.
So what is the thing that you don't want to do?
I don't want to stop. Like, I want to, but I don't want to. Like, I'm not ready to stop. I don't want to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't want to be in rehab. I don't want to do any of that. I just want to get a little bit better.
A little bit better.
Yeah.
Hey, Death, Sex, and Money. Here's a little update for you.
At the end of our conversation, I asked Jackie to keep in touch. And a couple of weeks after we talked, she sent me a voice memo.
Just to keep it short and brief, I got way too drunk a couple weekends ago and don't remember how I got back upstairs. I was at my apartment's pool and I just woke up in my bed and speaking gibberish to my boyfriend. And my roommate came in and I told her what has been going on and that I'm struggling. And I cried to them. And he actually started recording me on his phone so that I could listen to it later and see how I wasn't making any sense. And once I realized that he was recording me, I just started sobbing and saying that I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to drink like that anymore. And he said, okay, well, say it to my phone so you can listen to it and hear yourself. And I did.
That's a listener we called Jackie. Right before we first put out this episode in 2019, she wrote to say she'd decided to quit drinking for a month. And she told us this week, in 2022, that didn't last. The beginning of the pandemic was really tough for her. She went through a breakup and leaned hard into drinking as a way of coping. She said she's since gotten a diagnosis of bipolar 2 and has medication that's working for her and regular therapy and is mostly avoiding drinking now. She said things aren't perfect, but I just turned 24, she wrote. I have an amazing job, my very own adorable apartment, and I'm starting back at college next year. If you are struggling with your alcohol use or wondering if the way you're drinking is a problem, we have a link in our show notes to a list of resources.
Death, Sex, and Money is a listener-supported production of WNYC Studios in New York. This episode was produced by Annabelle Bacon with help from Katie Bishop, Zandra Ellen, Christina Josa, and Emily Nadal. The rest of our team includes Julia Furlan, Zoe Azoulay, Afi Yellowduke, Emily Botine, and Andrew Dunn. Our intern is Lily Clark. The Reverend John Delure and Steve Lewis wrote our theme music. I'm on Instagram at AnnaSalePix, that's P-I-C-S. And the show is at Death Sex Money on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Thank you to all of you for sharing your stories about drinking. Here's one of mine.
My daughter was not yet three when my parents were visiting and they sat down and she said, "Do you want an old fashioned?" I was like, ah!
That's really funny.
I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC.